I'm Christopher Lydon with the Scots-English journalist and historian of India, William Dalrymple, who went native, as they say, in the old mystic village society 20 years ago, just as India started transforming itself into a roaring capitalist tiger. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. William Dalrymple, I've studied with fascination your new book, Nine Lives, about the pressure, really, of galloping modernization and growth on the sacred in India. I want to hear all about the commercial boom that has the world's largest shopping mall crowding now your old farm on the outskirts of Delhi. We'll talk about Nine Lives, too, but then I want to get to our American predator drone war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, that is the sort of booming noise in the background of your story. Start with you. How Willie Dalrymple, a reporter in India, stayed, took root.
Well, none of it was planned, I think, is the first thing to say. India's a bit like that. Even my first trip to India wasn't really planned. As a kid, I was very interested in archaeology. I used to spend all my summer holidays digging on archaeological sites in Scotland and England. Old Neolithic causewayed camps and fabulous old brochs in the Orkney Islands and this sort of thing. And before I went up to Cambridge, I got myself what for me was a complete dream job, which was working on a Babylonian site in Iraq called Tel Brak for 9 months before going up to Cambridge to study archaeology. And just, I think, 2 weeks before I was due to set off on this trip, and I had images of sort of, you know, turning into the next Leonard Woolley of or kind of one of these fantastic sort of Howard Carter figures unearthing treasures in the deserts of the Middle East. 2 weeks before I was set off to do that, Saddam Hussein intervened in my life for the first time and closed down the British School of Archaeology, saying it was a nest of British spies, which it may well have been for all I know. With nothing to fill the next 9 months, I went off with my best friend, who was got himself a job teaching in a school in India, and arrived in India knowing absolutely nothing about it, with no interest in the country, and even possibly mild aversion. I mean, it was very much a kind of because my friend was going rather than because it was anything I was particularly interested in. And my life changed from that date. I landed in India on the 26th of January, 1984, and in many ways really have never left. I still spend 10 months a year in India. I've written 7 books, of which only one doesn't concern South Asia.
And you become co-chairman of the Jaipur Literary Festival, which makes you sort of a pillar of the modern literary scene, no?
Well, I founded this tiny little festival in Jaipur 4 years ago, which has done sort of what the Indian economy has done to my mix of sort of horror, surprise, and pleasure. Jaipur, which started off only in 2005 with 14 people in a room, most of whom were tourists who'd taken the wrong turn and ended up in this reading by mistake. Last year, grown to 35,000 people and is the largest free festival of literature in the world, I think, now. Mm. My proudest boast about Jaipur is we don't have an office, we don't even have a telephone. It's all done from my BlackBerry. it's probably the most chaotic literary festival in the world, but it kind of works in its own Indian way.
I want to go.
21st to 25th January every year, completely free. Everything's done by sponsorship. Anyone can turn up. And what's unique about it, I think, is that it sort of turns into sort of Woodstock in the evening. From 6 o'clock onwards, there's music and dancing till 2 in the morning.
In the meantime, India has become a boomtown. Openly capitalist American ally, far cry from Nehru's India that I saw once upon a time.
And an even further cry from Gandhi's India of village republics and spinning wheels. I mean, it couldn't be further from the dream of the founder of the nation.
How's it for you?
Well, I love it still, I have to say. I mean, what's interesting about development in India is it hasn't sort of swept away the old. It's just sort of encircled the old. So all the things I used to love when I first went to Delhi, the calligraphers in the old city, the Sufis in the Sufi shrines, the old Muslim gentlemen in the old city speaking courtly Urdu, the flying pigeons from their roofs, the calligraphers, all this sort of high courtly culture, it's still there. It's just that, as well as that, there's now a new, there was two boomtowns to the east and to the south of Delhi. One's called Noida, one's called Gurgaon, and both are about 5 million people. And if you count Greater Delhi, including those two, it's this huge megalopolis of 15 million, heading for 20 million fast. And in those Delhis, there is the headquarters of Microsoft Asia, the headquarters of Google Asia, all these back office processing units, all the stuff one reads about in Tom Friedman's Flat World stuff. But what's intrigues me is that, I mean, and I'm not against any of that stuff. I mean, I've got my kids in Delhi. We all like going off to having a choice of 10 movies rather than just one black and white Indian movie, which is what the case was when we moved there. And it's nice to be able to choose, you know, cuisines from around the world rather than just having dal and rice every day. So, that, you know, there's no question there are many positive material gains, having decent roads, having electricity that doesn't go off the whole time. This is beginning to be the, you know, all that is coming. But what's intriguing to me, and what's one of the kind of themes in Nine Lives, is that that boom, while not exactly fragile, is very partial. You've only got to go 10 miles down the road from the headquarters of Microsoft Asia to find bullocks ploughing the ground with wooden ploughs. And even more odd is the kind of mindset of people suspended between modernity and tradition. I think it's a transitional moment. That may change in 20 or 30 years' time. But at the moment, you have this world where there are a lot of people who look like the people that walk the streets of New York, who wear Nikes, who have satellite TV and maybe watch Baywatch or any of these series that people enjoy here. But what's going on in their heads is very, very different from what is going on in the heads of most people in New York. Mm. And it seems to me that the job of the travel writer today is no longer what it was in the 19th century, which is sort of marching out like Livingston and Stanley and finding Lake Victoria and penetrating the unknown quarters of the globe. It seems to me that the job of the travel writer today is to sort of strip off that very thin veneer of globalization, which still hides a multitude of different attitudes. We think today, because of our technology, because of the internet, because we can type in Google Earth and can look at a street in Siberia or Singapore or Saigon with huge ease and just walk down the road virtually, that we understand and know the world, that it's been mapped and gridded and studied. As 9/11 revealed so dramatically, we don't understand the world. There are huge areas of the world about which we know virtually nothing. Right. And even our greatest intelligence agencies, with their ability to filter 20 million emails in a second and do all the gizmo stuff, left kind of blindly gasping for air in the face of a whole series of other realities which they hadn't even begun to grasp. So I think that travel writing, which is what I think of Nine Lives as being part of, this it's a very English genre. There's been this long tradition in Britain of writers such as Robert Byron, Peter Fleming, Wilfred Thesiger, going back a century, Richard Burton, going further back, Gerald of Wales. There's this great tradition of traveling and trying to understand and trying to explain. And
could I just say at this point, your last book, The Last Mogul, which we talked about, was a corrective also on this. I mean, that was Willie Dalrymple, the historian, and part of what you were seeing was that things looked different 150 years later. That was mostly about the Sepoy Mutiny, as the Brits called it, of 1857.
The Indians, first war of independence of the
exactly.
Indians.
Exactly. I mean, things look different from different perspectives, and they keep changing. But with all that in mind, I'm listening for what Miss Quested in E.M. Forster's Passage to India called the real India. Where do you track it among all these strands today?
There is no one real India. There are very many millions of Indians.
Maybe never was, right?
I think I can say there's a real America. I mean, there's real America in the prairies. Is it in New York? You know, there are as many different Americas as there are different Indias. These are both two vast countries with large numbers of people living very different lives in different places. And so I think, you know, one of the reasons I chose to do Nine Lives in the form I did, which is nine people telling their own stories, giving their own perspectives, or each one from a different religious tradition, each one in a very real sense, in a completely different theological, cosmological understanding of the world. These guys look at the world from their own self-contained moral universes and see very different things around them and have very different ideas of what life is there for. And because the sheer vastness of India, it seemed, you know, impossible to go and do anything encyclopedic. This is a book on Indian religion, which doesn't contain half the religions of India. There's no Sikhs in here. There's no Zoroastrians. There's no Indian Jews. There's no Indian Christians.
These, should I say, nine lives of sadhus and swamis, a giant nun, a temple prostitute, all sorts of people embodying the old-time religion that we used to think was all of India. It was all firewalkers and men lying on beds of nails kind of thing. Pick one and make a story of it for us.
Okay. Well, the story, I suppose, that I'm most pleased with in the book, which is the one I led with, is the story, oddly enough, of the person of all of them I spent least time with. Many of these stories I've gone back five or six times. Some of them are great friends. Many of them are actually here with me in the States, and we're traveling together as part of a roadshow. We've been touring Australia, South Asia, Britain,
I heard
Europe.
Those bowel singers last night. I heard Hari Das, too. Very moving people. Go on.
But Prasannamati Mataji, who is the Jain nun, is someone I met only for 72 hours, and yet of all of them, I think she's the one that left the saddest cut, I think, on my heart. An extraordinary story, one to this day which I don't really know how to react to. People in America, I don't think, really know who the Jains are. I've never heard of them. I mean, everyone knows who Buddhists are. Half the population of California seems to be Buddhist. But the Jains are another religion coming out of India at roughly the same time. Mahavir, the founder of the Jain religion, was a generation or two before the Buddha. But like him, living in this world of early city-state India, the first great civilized urban Indian civilization. This is the world that the Kama Sutra came out of, the most encyclopedic guide to lovemaking for the young Nagarika, the young man about town. And in many ways, the Kama Sutra was what both Mahavira and the Buddha were reacting against, what they saw as the materialism and sensuality of what was this new urban civilization, full of money, full of riches, full of beautiful women, full of gems and stones. And both Mahavir and the Buddha reacted against this and advocated in very different ways ascetic paths. Now, Mahavir came first, and in the Jain religion is one that is very severely ascetic. It advocates punishing yourself, but being extremely gentle on the world. So, on one hand, monks walk the roads of India, sweeping it with a peacock brush ahead of them so as to move all ants aside, to avoid hurting any living creature. They wear masks over their face so that they don't breathe in any insect. They won't walk during the monsoon in case there's a hidden life in the puddles that they step upon. And yet, that gentleness with the world is matched with a deep severity against their own bodies. They pluck out their hair by hair, as part of their novitiate. They're not allowed to beg for money. They're not allowed to touch money at all. They're not even allowed to beg for food. If no one gives them food, they go hungry. And the highest point of Jain asceticism, which they aspire to at the end of their monastic careers, is to starve themselves to death. We would regard it as suicide. They regard it as the ultimate divestment of attachments, to lose even your attachment to food and life. And to die for them in that situation is not to commit suicide and do something negative and negate life. It is merely to change an old set of clothes and to pick up a new set in your next reincarnation. Now, the Buddha, of course, reacted against this sort of severity, and his middle way, was a set up in reaction against that sort of severity. He said it's not necessary to punish your body. What you need to do is look inwards. And while the other difference is that while the Buddhists stationary, the Buddha received his enlightenment sitting under a tree, the Jains are walkers, and walking is a very important part of their life. Now, Prasannamata Mataji came across a teacher who persuaded her to change her life, and at a very young age, at about 15, she left her rich merchant family, and she gave up all her wealth. She had plucked her hair, and began walking with the Jain Sangam, or community, through India. And very early on, she met her great friend Priyogamati, who was another daughter of another rich merchant, and the two hit it off. And Priyogamati decided to become a nun too, and the two girls took their vows together. And for 20 years, they walked the roads of India together. And Priyogamati and Prasannamati Mataji became extremely close. At some point, it became clear that Priyogamati was getting ill, though, and then it was eventually diagnosed as TB. She started spitting blood, in a particularly gruesome form of TB called Cox's syndrome, where the whole digestive system packs up. And faced with the prospect of imminent death, Priyogamati decided to embrace Salakanda, this ritual fast to the death. And they do this in a very set manner over usually about 3 years. You slowly, slowly begin to limit the number of foodstuffs you eat. So 1 week they give up dal, lentils. Another week they give up rice. Until eventually they're drinking only water and milk, and then water, and then they give up that. And Prasannamati Mataji described her job as being in spiritual charge of her friend's extinction, supervising her salakana, gathering the community at the end as she lay bedridden, saying prayers and reciting mantras around her bed, until eventually she slipped away. And Prasannamati Mataji said, I thought I had lost all my attachments. I'd given up my family. I'd given up my possessions. I'd followed all the rules correctly, and yet I had one attachment left, and this was Priyogamati, and that gave an opening to suffering. And now I am distraught. And she, and 3 years later, she is now in the process of embracing Salakana herself.
Mm.
And it's very difficult to know how to react to that story. I mean, to this day, do you say this is an entirely negative thing? Do you take a kind of Dawkins position and say, this is a completely wasted life? Or do you admire someone who has taken an extremely difficult path and followed their religious convictions to the fullest? You know, it's a mountain. You can go around and see completely different shapes depending on which side you look at it from. And but it's certainly a very sad story.
I walk around it wondering all of those things, but especially about the context of India today. There are 9 of these stories, all of them entirely different, exotic but real, in the context of kind of secular India, on one sense, the heritage of Nehru and Gandhi, but also of Hindu nationalist India, much more uniform, militant, clear, simple, familiar in a world of religious America, religious Islam.
Absolutely. And what is interesting is that the way religion is changing in India is it's basically undergoing a middle classization, which means it did what religion in Europe began to do in the Reformation, which is it becomes more textual, less local, less superstitious, in inverted commas. And so you have a move from the local saint, the local shrine, the local god, to a national god, a national religion, and a more textual religion. In Reformation Europe, you had the saint shrines destroyed. The British know people to preach to the Taliban. The greatest destruction of idols in history took place in the cathedrals of Britain under the reign of Edward I. When you can still go to Ely Chapter House and see all these necks of which once had saints and kings' heads on, all these empty niches in the front of the cathedrals. And this was, again, the product of a new middle class, a newly literate middle class, looking to the religious text and away from superstition and tradition. Exactly the same is happening in Hinduism and in Islam in India and Pakistan today. In Hinduism, you have a move from the local gods, the local godlings, the tree spirits, the nagas, the little shrines under the trees, the little piles of rocks among the tribals, to the great national hyper-masculine gods like Lord Shiva, Lord Ram, Lord Krishna, the Devi in her most obvious forms, Lakshmi, the goddess of wealth. And these are the gods who are flourishing in modern urban India. And it's a first cousin of what's happening in Indian Islam and indeed Middle Eastern Islam, and particularly in Pakistani Islam, which is a move from a gentle, pluralistic Sufi faith, often rooted in the shrine of a mystic poet saint at some point in history, who people revere. The women will go and tie threads through the lattices asking for babies or success in exams or jobs for their husbands, to a much more austere, puritanical, Wahhabi textual Islam based on the Quran, propagated by madrasas funded from the Gulf.
And let's be real, there's a parallel also to the transformation of American Christianity from barefoot Jesus to the Christ.
I'm in no position to talk about American Christianity. I'll have to take your word for it, but it sounds right to me, yeah.
And meantime, back in India, you're a bronze maker in a family that goes back to our Middle Ages.
Stapati, yeah.
Yeah, his sons are telling him, Dad, it's about software. Let's go.
Okay, so in 11th century India, some of the most beautiful, most sensual artworks ever created in Indian art are the famous Chola bronzes. The most famous of those is the famous image of the dancing Shiva, that famous bronze that you see and reproduced all over India of Shiva dancing the world into extinction and redancing it into existence. And with a great halo of flame around this dancing figure. The master craftsman who made those idols under Rajaraja Chola, the great king of South India in the 11th century, 35 generations later, their descendants are still living in the same village, making the same idols according to the same specifications of the Shilpa Shastras, the scriptures which lay down the rules for idol making. And these rules are very, very specific. When you make an idol, which is to become a god, it is a religious duty. And so you don't just go in and sort of start chipping away. You before you begin an idol, you have to undertake a ritual fast. You can only begin it at certain phases of the moon. You have to mime with certain mantras as you're chipping away. You have to try and keep your mind on the deity like a process of meditation. You can't just think about the bills or the pretty girl walking down the street or whatever's happening in the family. You have to concentrate on the idol. And finally, it's the chipping open of the eyes, which opens the deity's eyes and brings the deity to life. Now, this has been going on for centuries, but India is changing, and even in small town R.K. Narayan village Tamil Nadu, change is afoot. So, most obviously, the idol orders come no longer from the great temples of Tamil Nadu, but instead from the Tamil diaspora living in San Diego and L.A. and Silicon Valley and the Bay Area. And particularly ISKCON, the Hare Krishna consciousness headquarters in California. While at home, the two boys, the two young men who will inherit this business, want to go off and write JavaScript in Bangalore. Better paid, easier work, they say. And the father sits there shaking his head saying, I can hardly say this is the age of the bronze maker. This is the age of the computer. What can I say to them?
Well, Dalrymple, I want you to put all of this in the context of the ongoing war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and I want to hear your take on it as the man who found a new life in India and has studied it as closely as any Western guy I know, what is going on? And I'd like to put it in the context of your remarks to the Asia Society in New York last night.
Well, I think, in truth, the war on terrorism is as far distant for most people in India as it is to most people in America. Occasionally, it intrudes in the same way as 9/11.
Not suddenly, those singers from Pakistan, I don't think.
Well, I was about to say that. It's different from Pakistan. But in India, life goes on its own way in the same way as it does in America. And suddenly, there's what seems to be some inexplicable atrocity. The attack on Bombay last year, hundreds of innocent civilians gunned down for no apparent reason. Just as for most New Yorkers, the loss of the trade towers, the deaths at Ground Zero seemed to happen for no good reason. Why were these people doing this? You get greater clarity, though, when you go to Pakistan. Pakistan is a country which had many problems from its founding in 1947, when it was envisaged initially as a refuge for Indian Muslims who perceived a threat of living under Hindu fundamentalist rule. The same groups who assassinated Mahatma Gandhi in 1947, the RSS, the extreme Hindu right, used to quote the Nazis as an example of what they should do, as they put it, to their Semitic minority. We should take the example of Kristallnacht, wrote the founder of the RSS, and in a book called We, Our Nationhood Defined, and teach these Muslims that they can live here only as second-class citizens at our pleasure. So faced with this sort of stuff, Indian Muslims felt they needed a refuge. They founded Pakistan. The history of Pakistan has been a long series of tragedies and disappointments, an oscillation between corrupt democratic governments and military dictatorships, which have been no less corrupt. Then the great turning point was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and Pakistan suddenly became everybody's most important staging point in the attempt to turn back the Soviet tide. So the Americans, the CIA, and the Saudis land in particularly Peshawar, the town on the northwest frontier, and set up their intelligence operations and pour money into this area, pour guns into this area. And the Saudis and the Americans both believe that there is an important role in this struggle against the Soviets by encouraging holy warriors. So madrasas are founded and funded with CIA consent, with Saudi money, which radicalizes the population as part of American policy, as part of Saudi policy, to get rid of the Soviets. Of course, as we all know now, we created a monster which we haven't even begun to be able to control, nor indeed have the Pakistani intelligence been able to control it. They believed long after America had and the Saudis had begun to get slightly anxious about what they had created, the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, believed that they could use these jihadis not just against the Soviets, but against the Indians in Kashmir, and could infiltrate the highly radicalized Afghan Arabs. This Islamist Frankenstein's monster that had been created in the crucible of Peshawar as a way of tying down the Indian army. Pakistan, a small country surrounded by this huge giant India, realized they can never fight India in a conventional war, so they have to, in a sense, punch beneath the belt and have, as they see it, strategies of tying down this vast Indian army, a billion people on their doorstep, hostile to them, as they perceive it. So they fund the jihadis, they send them into Kashmir, and it is in this world that Al-Qaeda is created and the current mess begins. Now, from Al-Qaeda, you get 9/11. From 9/11, you get the American invasion of Afghanistan. And from the American invasion of Afghanistan and the NATO occupation of Afghanistan, you get the blowback, which has been the single most dangerous result of the entire adventure.
I was just going to say, Al-Qaeda didn't make this mess alone. I'd love you to talk about the contradictions around this monster ongoing. This is a little sticky because for me, there were wincing moments with the Asia Society last night. For example, when you introduced the singers and dancers from India and Pakistan, and you said, you were joking, but you said, they're not all here because some of them didn't get through Homeland Security, and a lot of these people had the same names as major operatives of Al-Qaeda. People at the Asia Society laughed, but the joke had been turned on these artists who'd come to inspire, not on us who can't seem to tell our friends from our enemies over there.
Well, I think the joke was certainly aimed at obtuse CIA and Homeland Security officials. I certainly wasn't aimed at my friends who'd come with me. But
I was looking at those, the singer and the accompanist, and I'm thinking, you know.
No, I mean, we've spent the whole last 3 weeks banging our heads against the walls because these guys who are leading Sufi singers who have spent their life facing off the Islamists in a way that no Americans have ever had to do, living, preaching moderate, liberal, plural Islam against a bunch of fanatics funded from Saudi Arabia. The Sufis are the front line in the battle for moderation, pluralism, a more mystical, spiritual Islam against this highly radicalized, political, militant, jihadi Islam. So these guys are people we should be, you know, buying first-class tickets for, putting up in a suite in the Carlisle and fating and helping in every way and supporting and congratulating. What happens when they apply for a visa to come and bring their mystic message of love to Park Avenue? Homeland Security holds them up for 3 months and allows only two of the six through.
There's so many ironies in that, Willie, if I may say. I mean, you praised them and you held them up as a much better shield, as you say, against the Taliban than our war is.
Well, it is a war they have been fighting long before we ever fought it. There is 1,400 years of history of a battle for the soul of Islam, fought between the mystics of Islam, who in many ways represent the Islamic New Testament. The Quran is a book very like the Old Testament, which emphasizes judgment and justice. The Sufi mystics, from Rumi through Nizamuddin, through all the Rahman Baba, the great mystics of the Middle East and South Asia, have preached a message of love, which in many ways it resembles the message of Jesus Christ in the New Testament.
And yet, you and we automatically embrace them into our war. And I was sitting there last night thinking, what is our war, Willie Dalrymple, at a moment when Hamid Karzai, our guy, is talking about going over the hill to the Taliban? I mean, what are we talking about?
Well, it's certainly true that the war has lost all semblance of shape or form. What we've done in Afghanistan, effectively, is to take sides in a civil war which has been running in Afghanistan since the 1970s. We have sided with the North against the South, with the Tajiks against the Pashtuns, with the town against the country, and with a vision of secularism against a vision of an Islamic Republic. The Pashtuns are the majority in Afghanistan, and yet they are almost completely excluded from the higher echelons of the armed forces and the civil service. And that is has always been a completely unsustainable regime. There is no way that you can keep the Pashtuns out of government. They are two-thirds of the people of Afghanistan. They're also the fiercest and most militant people in Afghanistan and will fight for their rights, as they have always done. The stupidest thing we ever did after entering Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban, which I have to say was in principle not an unreasonable thing to do and not an unwinnable war, because the Taliban were extremely unpopular. No question. I was there at the time. The Taliban were hated. And it would have been very, very easy had America showed its goodwill by building roads, building schools, streetlights, and acting with a measure of generosity and foresight to have kept the Afghans extremely happy. But instead, what they did was that they put all their resources into military and security. Of the $60 billion that have gone into Afghanistan, $57 billion have gone on security and armaments and arms building. And Kabul is a hell of a shock to visit today because, I mean, I'm used to sort of grotty South Asian towns and I've spent a lot of time in the boonies of Pakistan. But there is not a single town in Pakistan which has roads as bad as Kabul, which has the lack of street lighting, the lack of sewage, the lack of rubbish collection. Pakistan looks like Beverly Hills compared to Kabul after $60 billion have been poured into it. So the Afghans, and one after another, I mean, the Afghans are very sort of perfectly sensible people. They're not sort of nutcases. They look and say, where's all, you know, you say you've given us $60 billion. Where the heck is it? There are no schools. There's no rubbish collection. There's no sewage. What have you done? Where? And the answer is it's been spent on military. And it's been spent on creating an army, which is entirely an enlarged version of the Northern Alliance. There are no Pashtun officers in the modern Afghan army. There are no Pashtun generals. There are very few Pashtun ministers, and they've been brought in belatedly in attempts to try and shore up this government. So what we've done is create a completely unsustainable regime that was never going to survive and which has now, 10 years later, made the Taliban appear national heroes, and they're being welcomed back, and they will be back. I would be amazed if the Taliban aren't in Kabul by the end of the year.
Come back to what seems to me one of the fundamental ironies, even in your presentation last night. You paid your respects to the former chairman of the Asia Society, Richard Holbrook, for helping get some of these singers and dancers through customs and immigration. But you didn't mention that he is, at least nominally, directing the AFPAC strategy, including these satanic predator drones that, as you said forthrightly last night, are killing large numbers of civilians every week, if not every day, undermining anything like what would seem a moral policy.
But this is exactly what I said on the podium. The drones are now the biggest weapon the Taliban have. Every time a drone lands in the middle of a wedding party, you sign up another village, another district to the jihad against the Americans. All you read in the papers here is the successful hits on militant hideouts, and you know, Beitullah Masud killed in drone attack. You get on the New York Times. What you don't get is what you get in Jung and Dawn and the Pakistani papers, which is five more wedding guests killed in a false attack. General Petraeus apologizes, and the Afghans say, you know, what?
But anybody can see this in a way. Why can't our friend Richard Holbrook see this? The same good guy who's getting these artists into the country seems to be on top of this policy.
I think there's no contradiction between thanking someone for getting your show into a country and criticizing his policy, which is what I've done in the New York Times and this week in The Observer. Holbrooke was described to me by a senior British diplomat as a bull who brings his own china shop wherever he goes. And I think my personal opinion is that the biggest mistake Obama has made in his appointments is sending Mitchell to Palestine and Holbrooke to Pakistan. Pakistan and India need someone with courtly graces and with a little bit of charm, while the Israelis need someone with an ability to scream back at them in a manner that they do. And Holbrooke would have been the perfect man to take on Netanyahu, who's the toughest nut in the entire Middle East, and the man that's holding up the peace process, in my view, more than anyone else. Holbrooke, though, has done unbelievable damage, I think, in the way he's lectured and talked down to Indians and Pakistanis and Afghans, and has not been a diplomatic diplomat.
He's
an extremely intelligent man, I have to say. Holbrooke knows his history and knows more about Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India than many other American representatives in the region. And in some ways is a very remarkable figure, but his style, I think, is too abrasive for that part of the world, where courtly graces are still important and politeness, and just like Richard Armitage promising to bomb Pakistan back into the Stone Age the day after 9/11 was not really the way to talk to your allies in the region.
Well, Dalrymple, so, you're just back from Afghanistan. I mean, tell us, between the lines, what's coming down?
I think the whole thing is absolutely on its last legs, and it's considerably worse than I had expected or been led to believe by reports I've read. My impression, having not visited for a while, was that there was, you know, trouble in the south. Helmand, Marja, and these sort of areas were fighting a full-scale battle against the Taliban. The reality is the Taliban are everywhere, right across the country. There are one or two areas where they are not. Mazar-e-Sharif in the far north is still fine to visit. The Panjshir Valley, the home of Massoud, the great Tajik leader, is the one example where there's been really good development. I saw some wonderful roads and hospitals and fire engines and all sorts of stuff going on there. But that's because it's always been the center of anti-Taliban. It's the one part of Afghanistan which didn't fall to the Taliban, and there's no way they're going to allow them back now. So they've embraced America and NATO and ISAF. Herat in the far west is okay. Everywhere else is very, very dangerous. Even in Kabul, with you know how many millions of Western troops and Afghan National Army, you can no longer walk around. And I did a bit of this, and everyone, I kept being sort of told off for walking around Kabul. I wear a Salwar Kameez, I speak pretty good Urdu, and I can get by. But everyone said, "You're mad, the kidnappers, you know, it is no longer safe to just go to the supermarket in the middle of Kabul. You can't do the basic things you can do anywhere else."
And what does
and it's much, much worse everywhere else. I mean, you go a mile south of Kabul and you're in Taliban territory. It is exactly the same as the Soviets in the 1980s. Kabul is completely surrounded. So the only answer now is you've got to have some way of bringing the Taliban and the Pashtuns into government. But there's no sense that Holbrooke or Obama are ready to break that to the American people. But it's blindingly obvious it's the only answer. The Brits are pulling for it, the Europeans are pushing for it, and Karzai is pushing for it. At the moment, the Americans are the only people, as far as I can work out, who are not taking the view that the Taliban have to be brought somehow into government.
And what does the military surge have to do with it? I mean, how does one measure its effects, its counter-effects, its undermining of itself or whatever?
I think the surge has been, as far as I can work out, I haven't been down to Helmand and I haven't been with the troops. So I haven't seen the military in operation, but as far as I can work out, it's been a complete and catastrophic failure. Everywhere they've gone, the Americans have announced where they're going to go. And if you're fighting guerrilla war, the first thing you don't do is you don't warn people. The Taliban will just creep out into the fields and then come back in, which is what's happened in Marja. Marja is now back under Taliban control, this place that was liberated from the Taliban, in inverted commas, with a great fanfare in April, is now again under Taliban control. So the surge has had not a single effect, as far as I can work out, other than probably alienating many more Afghan civilians in the south.
Meantime, President Obama has, alas, embraced the Predator drone as a joke, the defense of his children. How does that go down among people one can meet in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
It's, of course, deeply offensive. And the drones have been the Taliban's best weapon because they are not accurate. They are not the intelligence is simply not good enough to give you sufficient confidence that you're actually going to hit a militant target. There are always people offering information, and they're being paid for it by the intelligence agencies, and most of it appears to be rubbish, because the things that are getting hit are wedding parties, buses, schools, hospitals, children. It's a complete mess. And go anywhere in the northwest frontier of Pakistan, this is, I think, the most dangerous thing, is that, in a sense, Afghanistan has always been a mess. But Pakistan hasn't always been a mess. Pakistan has been a volatile country, but it has been a country that's basically under control and not anti-Western. The great danger is that when Afghanistan goes down, as it surely will within the next 9 months, the Pakistan state will be the next to go down with it. And already the Northwest Frontier, which is a place I spent many months and over many visits and have had many wonderful, I mean, I used to go for Christmas to SWAT every year, and I used to wander around these hills, and it's one of the most beautiful places in the world you can imagine. It's completely screwed. My favorite Sufi shrine in the world, the shrine of Rahman Baba in Peshawar, which is the tomb of the great poet Rahman Baba, the Nightingale of Peshawar. Which used to be a gorgeous place where refugee Afghan musicians would play in the light of the moon. I had many happy months sitting there listening to these guys on Thursday nights, reporting as a young reporter from Peshawar. That tomb was blown up by the Pakistan Taliban in March last year. You cannot go to Peshawar safely now. It is now off limits. The whole of the Northwest Frontier is up in arms. And you take your life into your hands going there. And I say, this is a place I used to go for my Christmas break. It's like imagining sort of the Hamptons suddenly becoming a kind of militant zone.
And as Salman Rushdie concluded in a remarkable talk at Brown University a couple of months ago, if Pakistan goes down, he said, we're all fucked.
Yeah, I think we are all fucked. I agree. It's a very, very alarming prospect, not least because, of course, Pakistan has nuclear weapons.
Not to mention the irony that when you look at those drones, they seem a version, they're the unpassengered version of the planes hitting those towers. They're kind of a miniature targeted, but often mistargeted, shot at civilians who didn't see it coming.
They're sinister looking things. I was in Jalalabad on my trip, and I went to a jirga there with some of the tribal elders. Interesting story, actually. And very indicative of why the Karzai government is failing. I was trying to get to Gundamuk, which is the site of the British last stand in 1842, the symbol of the failure of the first British attempt, the first Western attempt to take over Afghanistan. 18,000 East India Company troops march in 1839. Like our own war of our generation, a surprisingly effortless conquest. Enemy merge off into the hills. The British spend 2 years skating, playing cricket, and thinking they've got Kabul. It's even discussed about making Kabul the summer capital of the Raj. Then an insurgency starts among the Pashtun of Helmand, and it spreads northwards until eventually there's a revolution in Kabul. The two senior British leaders, the civilian and the military leader, both get murdered in the streets, and the East India Company troops march out in 1842 in the middle of winter and are ambushed on the return. 18,000 march out. One man makes it through to Jalalabad. And the last stand of the last 50 before that man escapes is at Gundamuk. Now, I wanted to go and see this place. My next book is about the First Anglo-Afghan War and the parallels with the present. I went with the only way to get to that area, because it's now all under Taliban control, is to go with the local leader. So I went off with a wonderful ex-Mujahideen, ex-Olympic wrestler called Anwar Khan Jagdalek, who's this mountain of a guy with cauliflower ears. And we went off with six trucks full of former Muj, all with kefirs wrapped around their heads and rocket-propelled grenades, the full Monty. And we got to his home village, Jagdalek, which is where, again, about sort of half the British army was massacred in 1842. And he was taken, fated by his people, and taken to his old entrenchments. A feast was laid on. By the time we'd actually finished this blessed feast, it was too late to go to Gundamuk, because it was 5 in the afternoon, light pulling in, with the darkness comes the Taliban back. So we headed to Jalalabad. When we got there, we found there'd actually been a major battle in Gundamuk on the site of the last stand between the villagers and the army. And what had happened was this. It was the poppy harvest. The previous year, the government had turned up, burnt the poppy harvest, and promised compensation. The villagers had accepted this because they were going to get their money anyway. of course, being the Karzai government, the money never turned up. So they go back again in November and they say, look, we want compensation, but more than that, we want alternative crops to grow next year. Give us pomegranate seed. It's a higher yield. We can make more money that way. And they're promised it again. Nothing turns up. So they then go back a third time and say, look, it's the planting season. We're going to plant poppies because it's all we've got. If you come and burn it again, we're going to resist. They plant poppy. The poppy grows. Harvest time comes. The government comes up to burn it a second time. Mm. What do? Of course, they turn to the Taliban. And the Taliban are waiting in ambush. When the government turns up, 9 police cars are burnt. 10 hostages are taken. The next day, I go to the Jirga, where the elders from Gundamak have come to discuss this with the local government to work out what the next move is going to be. They said they warned they're going to do this. They broke their word. It was a legitimate thing to do. And I talked to the elders, and where we were sitting in Jalalabad was, by chance, beside the Jalalabad airfield, which is one of the major takeoff zones for the drones. And as we were having this conversation, these sinister creatures, these pilotless craft, were taking up and landing the whole time. And they're very sleek looking. They look like stealth aircraft. They're much bigger than I'd thought from newspaper photographs. They're big things. They're only half the size of a full-size plane. They're like a small light aircraft. And one of the elders told me about interview he'd had with some American soldiers in a hotel in Jalalabad the previous week. And the American had asked, tell me, why do you hate us? We've come, we're trying to help, we're trying to bring democracy, we've built roads, why are you hating us? And the man replied, old elder with long beard, he said, because you come in our houses, you knock down our doors, you take our women by the hair, you kick our children, and we will not allow it. We will break your teeth like we broke the teeth of the British, and like the British, eventually you will leave. And apparently the soldier turned to his friend and says, what if the old men are like that? What hope is there for the young? And he said, the Americans know that this war is lost. It is only their politicians who pretend they can win it.
Willie Dalrymple, to me the question is why we Americans, with some vague notion of it, aren't up in arms. Even at the Asia Society, I felt, listening last night, that this was sort of a minstrel show of Indian artists and musicians for wealthy people in the seat of empire on the east side of Manhattan who know better but aren't saying, and they somehow do control this policy of the war.
Well, I think the most important thing is an attempt to understand, and you've got to start somewhere. And if you can get 400 people in an auditorium listening to musicians and to writing about this part of the world, you are helping understanding. There is no way that in a book launch in New York that you're going to turn back the war on terror single-handed. But I think I don't think it's a helpful attitude to say just because it's in Park Avenue and just because you've got some well-heeled people in the audience that there's no point trying to educate people about this. I think it's an important attempt at understanding. And if you lose the attempt at understanding, then everything else begins to fall down. Now, I understand what you're saying. I get when you have a rich audience in the Upper East Side looking at poor musicians from India and Pakistan, there is a two worlds meeting. But I think it is a meeting in dialogue. The audience got on their feet and they gave these guys a standing ovation. Certainly, the fakirs I've been working with, are extremely pleased to be here. They're extremely pleased to be paid and recognized for this tradition that they preserved, for which they've been attacked by the Islamists. And they're extremely grateful to get a hearing here and to come here and to be able to bring their arts here. So I think it's a slightly negative view you're taking, Chris.
Listen, a lot of consciousness was raised last night, and a lot of consciousness is raised in your book. And I want to thank you for it. Thanks for being there. Thanks for being a magnificent storyteller. And thank you for your generosity with open source. Willie Dalrymple, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Paul McCarthy, Ben Mandelkern, and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation. Mm-hmm.